Welcome to the Relationship as Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Shelby Lee. Outdoor adventure enthusiast, dog mom to Luna, world traveler, longtime meditator, espresso lover, and a trained somatic psychotherapist, trauma specialist, and certified coach. Talking about trauma doesn't have to be so daunting. From a connected place, we can navigate anything together. Looking forward to exploring with you today. Here we go. Before I bring Stephen on here in a moment and officially introduce you to him, I want to give him a proper introduction here and just share a little bit about Stephen. Stephen Terrell, PsyD, SEP, Somatic Experiencing Practitioner, is my mentor, my teacher, and the co-creator of one of the most revolutionary trainings I have taken on trauma called Somatic Regulation and Resilience. It's changed everything about how I work and how I be in life. He's also the co-author of Nurturing Resilience, a book that has forever changed my work and my own nervous system. His decades of experience shine through with compassion, skill, intelligence, and embodiment beyond what I've experienced with so many other clinicians. Out of a handful of extensive somatic trainings I have taken in the past 15 years, all of the puzzle pieces clicked together as I started studying with Stephen. He makes sense of so many concepts and ways of being together that were left out of previous trainings. Developmental trauma is that piece, and tending to it with this way of being is truly revolutionary. I see Stephen for consultations with my clients, around my clients, and we've developed a friendship and a bond over the last couple of years. I am ecstatic that he took the time to spend here on the podcast today. We weave in and out of a lot of topics. There's a lot of richness here. There are also several concepts that we mention and don't return to because we just hit the ground running. If there are things we mention like co-regulation or how we're doing therapy by holding the kidneys and the adrenals and the feet and the brainstem, things like this that we don't take the time to break down, I promise you will find that in other episodes in this podcast. So it will get delivered if you haven't found it yet, if we don't know what we're talking about. The entire relationship as medicine experience will offer the knowledge and the deepening around all of the concepts we share today in such an excited way. So with that said, the podcast can begin now. Welcome to Relationship as Medicine podcast. I almost started laughing before I started speaking because I am talking to one of my favorite people in the whole world. And I thought I'd play a game with him and just start speaking as though I was a completely different person. Just put on a real show. Just start the performance now. So, Stephen Terrell, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm just so happy that you're here. You really are truly one of my favorite people in the world. You have impacted my life in ways you still probably don't even know, and for sure the lives of every single person that I work with. Stephen Terrell is a, I think you call yourself a psychotherapist, is that right?
I do.
Okay. A psychotherapist who sees clients, specializes in developmental trauma, used to specialize in adoption, and trains people all around the world around a modality that he created. I think you have one that you created, one you created with Kathy Kane, and yeah. It is deeply somatic, very loving, very gentle, and one of the most revolutionary experiences I have ever known in terms of trauma healing. You're in Austin, Texas, and what else would you like us to know about you that I didn't share?
What else? Well, I'm a single dad with two sons, which is by choice. I adopted them both and raised them alone. That's kind of probably the best education I ever got was from my kids, just paying attention to them and being with them. I actually live in Pflugerville, Texas, which is outside of Austin. It connects to it, but it's Pflugerville, which is a very interesting place to be living. Very diverse, very welcoming, very loving little town. So that's who I am. Thank you, Shelby.
Yeah, I'm really grateful you're here. Stephen is, I call you my mentor when I'm talking to people. You taught me in your program somatic regulation and resilience. And I also like to think you're a friend. I don't know if you would feel the same way. But, you know, it works for me.
Yes, it works for me too. And I think that, you know, when you're around, there's so much stigma around should we be friends or should we not be friends? And the truth is that when you're working in this field and you keep being together, you become friends by default. And then that default turns into a nurtured relationship. And I think that that's the cool part about working in the part of the field that you and I both tend to move towards is the trauma realm. And so, yeah, I consider you a friend.
Definitely. Okay, great. All right. We're on the same page. Road trip can happen then.
Road trip can happen. Yes. I'm still waiting. My bags are packed. I'm sitting on the curb. So hurry up.
All right. I'll be there in a year or two. Well, our topic for today, which I'm sure we will address and also wander from, is around the power of hanging out in the therapeutic relationship, because the podcast is called Relationship as Medicine, and there's so many different ways that we can be in that therapeutic relationship that can be incredibly healing. And you, in my life, have been the master of showing me that it doesn't have to be just digging in the darkness and the depths and going past our edges and being in excruciating pain and being overwhelmed when we're doing trauma healing. You've shown me that we can be light, we can be casual, we can be laughing, we can be talking about the weather, and there's still something that's incredibly healing about that. And I'd love to hear you share about that.
Well, I think that, you know, what I want to say is that I didn't get here overnight. It took me, when I went to graduate school, I really thought and understood from my professors at that time that we were supposed to have some sort of answer. You know, there should be some sort of wisdom, that we bring this wonderful wisdom to the table when we're working in therapy. And it didn't take me very long to figure out that, you know, the wisdom had to be practiced. And then I realized that the wisdom wasn't even mattered, that it didn't matter at all. That what mattered was my ability to not have the answers, to not be the know-it-all in the pair. You know, not to be the one who takes the person, but the one who sits with the person as they explore the direction they're going into, and being able to lay back and just focusing on that interconnected relationship, focusing on being able to say, oh, I see you, and you being able to say, oh, I see you, without getting all of the jargon in the way, with all the action in the way, but really just coming into that relationship and going, oh, yeah, it doesn't matter if we're talking about a movie we saw or a TV show or a song we heard. If we're really connected and we're just sitting with one another without expectation, it begins to shift and bring on a state of regulation that, you know, many people walk away from and went, you know, they shake their head and say, what just happened? But I think that understanding that healing never happens in overwhelm, healing never happens without relationship, healing never happens without regulation. And really being able to sit in there and just say, let's not overwhelm each other. And I say each other because I'm also a participant. I can't just be the parent in the relationship. I can't just be the child in the relationship or the boyfriend or the girlfriend in the relationship. I have to just be me showing up in this relationship, in my authentic self, welcoming your authentic self. So I think laying back would be a great title for a new modality, just to lay back therapy. You know, come in, sit, just chat. Yeah. And build that relationship.
Yeah. Something that really strikes me about what you're saying is, you know, my objective when I come to you for sessions is consultation for clients, deepening the work that you teach. And it is so deeply therapeutic also, you know, on a personal level. And if I can reflect on, I think the primary thing that has happened over the last couple of years that I've known you has been the pressure has come off. Mm. It feels like I showed up to you just a pressure cooker. And with you sitting back, being yourself, welcoming all of the parts of me, something feels like there's not an expectation. Like, I don't need to be fixed. No. I don't need to be pathologized. I'm doing just fine, just here as myself in relationship to you. And it feels nonviolent in such a beautiful way.
I'm so glad. And that word pathologize, you know, it's not very far in graduate school before we're taught to diagnose. You know, those, you know, we all have that DSM class somewhere in grad school where it's now we're going to find how to pathologize and how to find something wrong with someone. You know, if we don't see it, we're going to look for it. And the reality is that we don't have to look for any of that, and we don't have to pathologize, and just realize we're all doing the best we can where we are with what we've been, you know, whatever's happened in our life, we're doing the best we can. And that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with us mentally. It just means that, oh, maybe someone wasn't there to connect with me when I was younger. Maybe I was not in a relationship when I was growing up that was safe enough for me. And maybe that's why I am the way I am today. Well, of course it is. You know, the whole place of being in this moment is that I'm in the moment with everything. I get asked frequently by people will say, well, what about past lives? Or what about, you know, epigenetics? You know, that theory of passing along trauma, unresolved trauma from one generation to the next. I get asked that a lot. And I always just say, it doesn't matter. Because you're trying to separate parts out of a human, and that's not our job. Our job is to be with who shows up. It's not to go out and find everything under the sun wrong with them, just realizing this is their normal. They're working as hard as they can, and it's not because of past lives or anything. It doesn't matter, because all I'm working with is this moment, coming into the moment of presence.
Mm-hmm. I find it really interesting in my brain. It kind of feels like a little bit of a crux to think about as practitioners who are supporting folks with trauma, how when we can lay back, when we can really sit back instead of be in that position of, I can help you, I can fix you, we can figure this out, I can do all the things, that it's not actually easy to get to that place of ease. And I'm imagining that it took some work on your part to be able to sit back and lay back. And I'm thinking about assisting all of the trainings that I've assisted, and I see so many new practitioners come in so excited to test out all their tools and skills and try to manipulate people's experiences unconsciously. And this modeling of sitting back and laying back, that takes an incredible amount of practice, trust. I'm curious what it is for you. How did you get there? How do you do that?
Well, I wish I could say, oh, it was a beautiful trip. And, oh, the view along the way was amazing. And, you know, I didn't make any mistakes. Oh, Lord, help me, Jesus. I made so many mistakes. And there were so many times that people would call and say, oh, I know you're the one who can fix, or you're the one who's going to help them, or you're going to be the one to save my child, or you're going to be, you know, you have these wonderful things. And I got caught up in that with my ego. I got way caught up into it. And I was like living in this ego space and realizing that, oh, I was just failing. And I had more failures than wins. And I was like, this is just really interesting. And it took me a while to figure out that I don't have to say yes to everyone, that I can pick and choose. And that just because somebody is manipulating us by telling us that we're doing something that other people aren't doing isn't a reason either to jump into that. And really, just after making tons of mistakes, tons of errors, and doing it tons of the wrong way, just sitting back and going, this is where I am. Let's have a cup of tea. Let's sit and just talk like two people talk, not like, oh, I see. So it's all because of your mother dancing on the roof of the car when you were 5 years old. Yes. You know, it's not so much as that. It could be a reflection of that, I guess. But it's more about just being together and listening, being together and sharing that moment.
Yeah. And how is that different? Because I know you're a somatic-focused practitioner. How is that different than talk therapy? I have my hands up in quotes.
Yes. Those two little pairs of rabbit ears. I think that was going jumping through there. But how do I do the somatic? Well, I don't do the somatic any different than I do any other part. I sit with the body. I work with the body very differently, somatically. I understand that the majority of information comes from the body up to the brain, not from the brain down to the body. So when I'm working, it's not about me using my intuition. Intuition is such an interesting word because I hear it so often. And it's more about me coming in and just saying, okay, I'm going to be here for 5 minutes, maybe on the right adrenal, maybe on the left for 5 minutes, maybe the brainstem for 5 minutes, but I'm going to balance my moves, and they're going to be very orchestrated and very clear and very consistent, and I'm going to work this way every time. And just really sitting back, and when the body does something different, not responding to it like, let me go take care of this foot that's jumping up and down, or, you know, those moments. If I have to inhale, there's something wrong. And so there's nothing wrong. And just being able to say, okay, so your foot's jumping up and down, and keep going where I am. Because hypervigilance, think about that kid sitting in the classroom and scared and afraid and looking around and jumping around, and people are diagnosed and saying, oh, your kid has ADHD, or they are oppositional defiant, or pervasive developmental disorder. There's all this list of things that are wrong when somebody's trying to stay safe. All this list. And intuition, I think intuition sometimes is a part of that for us, that we develop greater intuition to stay safe. It's like our hypervigilance has developed a subcategory called intuition.
Yes.
And so my intuition probably isn't that important if I'm sitting with you. My intuition is great because it's given me information. What gets wrong is if I share the information. And it's taken me a long time, and I still screw that up, to pull that back and go, wait, that's my information coming in. That's not information. I'm not here to share that information. It's just registering in me that, oh, this might be going on, or that might, or maybe it's me. I don't know. So I think that, you know, moving all of those things out of place. When I first did touch, I learned it by intuition. You stay until the kidney drops into your hand. And I can do that all day. But I don't even try to do that anymore. I don't even, that's not who I am anymore. Who I am is that I want to have somatic trust. And I understand that somatic dissociation is just as real as regular dissociation. And I also understand that dissociation is an organic gift that we all have. And when we start struggling and fighting against organic dissociation, we're playing God. And that's not my role. That's not my role in your healing. And if you dissociate and you go down a dissociative trail, I'll be right here at the trailhead waiting for you to come back.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to chase you down that trail or try to hold onto your foot and pull you back. Say, you can't go there. Wake up, wake up. Come back, come back. I've heard that so many times. And from trainings, people say, come back, you can't dissociate. Come here. I'm right here. And, you know, I learned attachment when we used to force tiny kids to look into our eyes.
Oh.
I regret that part of my life. But we did, because that's what we were told. Oh, this is what you have to do. If you can't look at people's eyes, you're not attached. That's the biggest bunch of bukka I ever heard.
Yeah.
But at the time, I believe it. So I made a lot of kids look in my eyes. Look in my eyes. Look in my eyes.
I am with you. I'm with you also on the adult level. We don't need to force people to eye gaze with us.
No, it's kind of creepy to me a little bit to think about being forced to eye gaze, you know? Oh, look into my eyes, Shelby. Follow me into my dream world. You know, it's kind of cultish, isn't it? It's nasty.
Yeah. Well, I think for a lot of people, the intention is good, but it's outdated information. And when I learned that babies, and you'll tell me if I'm right or wrong, but babies actually, they don't sit there and lock eyes at us when they're attached. Their gaze will land, and then they'll explore the room, then they'll come back and see your eyes, and then they'll look around. There isn't this intense thing that is this thing we call deep intimacy. The intimacy is that they can actually wander around the room and come back, and we're still right here when they come back.
That's exactly what I believe is true. That safety of the relationship allows them to explore. You know, without safety in relationship, I've seen a lot of kids over the years that can't go anywhere, can't get out of their houses, can't go to school, can't in so many places because they don't feel safe. And I'm you know, just trying to imagine for a moment, what would that have been like to feel so safe as an infant to allow my eyes to go look around the room? I don't know that I had that experience or that I could even have a felt of experience of that in this moment. I'm going, that is so foreign to me.
Yeah.
And I know it's true, but it feels very foreign.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me, I really wanted to ask you, because I don't know if I know much about this, about, you know, how you found your work. I wanted to say this body of work, but I know that took a long time. But what inspired you originally to be supporting people through therapy and things like that? Is there anything about your personal story that would be helpful here?
Well. Where do I start? I guess I could say I was born in Florida. My parents we lived on a large nursery where plants are grown. There was a house that was provided that I've been told. I can barely remember that house because we started moving when I was very young, and we moved at least every 3 to 6 months of my life because something would happen. Some event would take place, not always good events, and we would have to leave. And there was no ability to create long-term relationships or friendships. A lot of being sick, a lot of not much fun. So when I was seventh grade, lived next door to this girl named Laura. We would walk to school together, and she would just berate me all the way there because my tongue was hanging out. And I didn't know how to breathe without my tongue hanging out. And so I really then went, something's wrong with me. And then in high school, I wanted to go to college and was eligible for a scholarship for special needs students. And when I went, the psychologist tested me. He said, you'll never, ever be able to get through college. And you need to find another way to make a living. And so it was like I was bouncing around lost for a long time, and I kept wanting to go back. And when I was in my early 20s, my mother was dying, and I ended up with a therapist and really was able to separate and understand more about myself, my quirks, and my uniqueness, and motivated me. And then when I was a little bit older, took a course in chemical dependency counseling that didn't require anything but a high school diploma. And I did really well, and I went, well, maybe they were wrong. But mind you, I'm now 40 years old, and when this awareness comes in, and so I go back to college where I had failed, and finished. And I went to graduate school and finished. And, you know, all of those things came about to be. The greatest story that my sister always told was that when I was brought home from the hospital, my mother put me in her arms and walked away and didn't come back. Mm. And so I'm sure that feeling of separation, and I, you know, my brothers, everybody in my family got married very young, very, very young. And my mother pushed everybody out of the nest. She didn't. That was kind of her way, and I was kind of lost in limbo because I was the youngest, and it was difficult. A lot of bad things happened in my life to me, a lot of things that wouldn't have happened if there would have been a constant, stable relationship. You know, that's why in Transforming the Experience-Based Brain, I'm so adamant that we don't want to leave anyone out when we're moving from kidney adrenal to adrenal to brainstem to ankles. We don't leave any of that out because it's so important, I think, somatically that we're seen, where we are. And so my life, you know, I thought about becoming a hypnotist at one point. I thought about all these ways. I became a Reiki master way before I went back to school, because I knew I wanted to be in the healing arts. I just didn't know how I could get there or how I'd get through the door. And today, my biggest joke is still that I graduated from grad school before I ever got accepted. And I still don't know how that happened, but literally, I was getting ready to graduate and I got a letter of acceptance to the program. It was very odd, very odd. So, yeah, so it took me a long time, a lot of mistakes, a lot of wanting people to like me, wanting people to think that, you know, there was something. And then to move to this place of, you know, understanding what other people think about me isn't always my business. And then really coming in and just being me, you know, and I don't know why that threatens some people. And it has over the years threatened them. And I don't know why. I'll never understand that. Because I'm just me. I'm pretty transparent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like it took a lot of work to get there. And it's pretty impressive that you did, given that experience of your mom handing you to your sister and walking away and not coming back. That is a developmental experience that I imagine had a huge impact.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. It's strange to look back. And now I know, you know, I went through that whole period of being angry. at my parents. And, I'm not angry anymore. I know they too were doing the best they could, and they were living in their world of normal. And I can't fault them for not seeing that I was different.
Hmm.
You know, I was just different. I probably was more complicated because I couldn't tolerate so many. I couldn't tolerate smells, taste, visual things. I had lots of weird quirks, I'll call them.
You definitely still do.
Yes. I think that part of us is what makes us healers.
Mm-hmm.
I can show up with someone who's struggling and I understand it on a different level. I wish I wouldn't have learned it that way, though. I do wish that, you know, things could have been different.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. I think that that's a place we have definitely aligned, where I have felt normal is sitting with you and you being like, of course you feel that way. Of course you have all of these sensitivities. And again, not pathologizing. This is part of what makes you a healer. Your sensitivity is part of what helps you do what you do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just owning it. If I own it, you can't pathologize it.
Ooh, you could say that 10 times.
Yeah, I wish. But that's the reality of it. If I own it, it's mine. You can't pathologize because it's no longer, you know, it's not possible to. It's part of who I am. Mm.
Yeah. I hope you walk back into that, I think it was a psychiatrist's office, and threw your best-selling book at him. Whoever said that you weren't going to make it through college.
You know, what's funny is I don't even remember his name or what he looked like. I just remember he came to the house to tell my parents how stupid I was.
Mm.
And I can still remember that evening that he came in, but I don't remember what he looked like. So I'm sure that's my own dissociative self saying, you don't need to remember that jerk. But he didn't seem like a jerk then. He seemed like God. Like he had all this power because he'd given me this test and this was how I scored. And so this must be true.
Wow. What an impact.
Huge impact. And I think that's one of the things as healers, therapists, psychotherapists, whatever we are, we have to be aware of that our words impact. What we say affects. So yeah. Pathologize it doesn't help.
Yeah.
Being curious by laying back and being curious, I can find out tons more without hitting that resistance, because that's another big piece of it. People go into the think that, oh, I'm going to learn while I resist. You don't. There is nothing in that resistance except keeping us away from connectedness.
Mm-hmm.
So stepping lightly.
What I'm hearing from you is connection, presence, curiosity, co-regulation. Mm-hmm. These are the things that are foundation for healing.
Yeah.
Consistency, dependability.
Yeah. Being there. Yeah. People always look at me like I'm crazy because what I'm teaching, I say, and you need to be on time. And you don't need to stay overtime. There's no healing in overtime. Once you go into overtime, realize there's so much activation, nobody's getting better. So being able to stop and start on time, and those things are important. And one of the things I've learned from you, which is hilarious in some ways, is how to disconnect from the work. How to say, I'm taking today off, and this is who I am, and forget it. I'm out of here today. And you've shown me many times how you could just go to the hot springs and have a wonderful time by yourself. You can go there and you can do that. And I'm thinking, oh, wow, how brave she is. How miraculous that must be. Because I would love to go to the hot springs by myself and sit. And I remember trying once about 10 years ago, and I got too scared and couldn't get out of the car. And went back home. But you have been an inspiration to me, Shelby, just the way you're able to go. And, you know, I remember the whole, I'm going to drive my car through Mexico for a month or two. And I was like, oh my God, she's going to go all by herself. And there was a part of me that just wanted to beg you to let me go with you, just so that I could be sure that you and you were going to be okay. But then I thought, who's going to be sure I'm okay? So that may not have been a good thing.
I would have totally had your back.
then maybe I'd have gone, yes. But yeah, you've inspired me huge. But the only way that happened is that I wasn't in control of knowing you. I was able to give and then receive. Give and receive, back and forth. That's co-regulation. Give and receive. Oh, yeah. I'm not the smartest one in the room when I operate this way. And God forbid, if I had to be the smartest in the room, that would not work. I tried it. It doesn't work. But this way does. Just, oh, yeah. She's doing it. And now I can do it. Now I've done it. I block schedules and getting much better at realizing if I have to cancel a session, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah,
they'll be here when I get back.
Yeah, I saw you sent an email out this morning blocking out a bunch of time off.
Yes.
And I don't know if you got my response, but it was essentially, it was, I'm so glad, woohoo, fuck yes, go.
Oh, thank you. I've not seen it yet. I haven't been in email, but yeah. I'm off from the 16th through after the New Year's, and I'm like, yes.
Yeah. I listened to a podcast where Janina Fisher was being interviewed about things she wished she had known earlier in her career, and she's also a trauma somatics expert who was my teacher. And she went on this whole journey around working with clients when she was in her early years, where in her time off, she'd be reading their full journals and pouring through all of these communications they sent her, answering all of their phone calls on her weekends, just all client time. And then her supervisor or someone was just like, you have to stop. And she noticed that as soon as she stopped was when her people started getting better. And I will never forget listening to that and feeling the impact of it in my body and understanding how we really have to trust our clients and we have to take care of ourselves above all else, because I cannot support people all day, every day if I'm overextended. And I know we say that all the time, but I have to advocate for my schedule like nothing else I advocate for in my life. It is the number one thing I protect so that I can keep doing what I do and actually love it.
I think I wish I would have known that way earlier on too. I think that that's definitely one of the directions we all go in, is that wanting to be too much. You know, let me read this, let me do this for you. Being able to take care of ourselves, you know, I have this thing that's kind of weird. And I went through it yesterday. Yesterday, I had some stuff done and I was in a lot of pain, dental wise, and some swelling and stuff going on. And I thought, I have an appointment starting in 10 minutes. I just got back home. I can't do it. But instead of immediately sending the email, I had to sit on it. And to sit on it, because in my mind, I take my hourly rate and I think, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go lay down and I'm going to put an ice pack on my face and I'm going to go to sleep. And here's my hourly rate. Which one is more valuable? Because I was raised where strike while the iron is hot. No matter what you work, if there's somebody there who wants to buy, you sell. You know, that attitude is the whole survival attitude my parents had coming through the Depression, living through those times, that they passed on. interesting, not all of my siblings got it, but I got it. And so I really struggle with, that's a very expensive nap I took yesterday.
Mm.
And for a moment of thinking, that's an expensive nap. And then to be able to say, oh, no, no matter what. And I typed out the email and sent it to the person and said, I'm sorry, I just cannot show up. And then I had a big two-hour consultation, and I just called and sent a text to a therapist who can step in for me. And I said, can you? And she said, of course, I'll take it over. So I ended up with 3 hours to be able to lay down and put an ice pack and go to sleep.
Mm-hmm. I'm proud of you.
It was worth it.
Yeah.
It was very much worth it.
Yeah. It reminds me of how people talk about choosing to eat organic food, how, you know, in the moment it feels more expensive. It feels like there's a cost, but down the road, you're saving hundreds of thousands of dollars on medical care, right?
And without a doubt, because in the world of developmental trauma, oh my. Medical is all waiting for, you know, sitting there waiting. There's so many autoimmune diseases and so many, you know, chronic stress, you know, leaky guts, all of those, cancer, all of those mm-hmm. things that come out of not being able to take care of ourselves when we're more worried about safety around us, creating that safety than we are that external safety, than the internal safety of, oh yeah, today I can lay down and take a nap. You know, I sometimes have to look at all my bank account balances to be sure that, oh yeah, I'm not broke.
Mm-hmm.
I've been broke. I've come home and pulled in the driveway and the garage door not go up. I know what broke feels like. I've lived it and I've swam in it. I am very familiar with it. I grew up in it. I'm not broke. I can take a nap.
Yeah. That happened.
Yeah. It amazes me that here I am way down the road and somehow I'm still needing to look and see or think about, oh no. And when you take time off, you miss a whole week. Oh my goodness. It's a mm-hmm. big deal.
Well, also, I'm curious what happens when you actually do allow yourself to rest. I'm telling myself the story that something might happen where it's actually even more threatening than doing the thing that's, you know, showing up for work or the thing that's familiar. I imagine there's a whole nother level of nervous system activation that happens when you're choosing to rest, and something that might not feel so restful at first, right?
Well, oh golly gee, yeah. I'm thinking sitting and watching a whole series on Netflix or, you know, Hallmark Channel, watching 10 Hallmark movies in a row, sitting on the couch. Oh, yeah, I'm taking this time off, so I miraculously believe that somebody's going to drop into the room with a parachute and say, come on, let's go outside and play. Let's go do something fun. They don't show up. Nobody's parachuting in. So it takes me a while to just realize that the important part of not working for me is maybe it's just to pile up on the sofa. You know, maybe it's just to lay down and doze off when I want to. It's, that safety piece is there.
Yeah.
Without a doubt, it's there.
I have to say, resting is probably the hardest work I do. I have to take those weeks off because my body is saying it needs care, it needs attention, my whole system. But I have to go through a portal every single time I have a week off where I have to remind myself, like, look at the bank account, remember that I have a team helping me. I have to do some really intentional practices that help me settle, because otherwise I will just stay ramped, because there's a part of me that is afraid if I allow myself to stop, everything will crumble. The shoe will drop. All of the successes that have come will evaporate if I'm not the one doing it all, holding it up, and staying in motion, then things could get really bad. So choosing to rewire my system to receive rest, to allow rest, to sink into rest, to feel safe enough to settle, it actually takes a couple days for me to even get to a place where it's not highly uncomfortable.
Yeah, I definitely identify with that. And it's relatively, life was pretty, there was a lot of struggle growing up. And I remember when I was in the fifth grade, I came home from school riding my bicycle, and there was a truck backed up in front of the house, and they were loading up the furniture and stuff, and then they took my bicycle. And I was like, what's going on here? And everything was being repossessed. And we left that night in the middle of the night with a few mattresses in a paneled van and drove to Georgia. And I can remember everything I knew was now behind me, gone. It was all gone. And then as an adult, when I was in college, I didn't have any money. I was struggling, and I had a car repossessed. And I can remember coming into a parking lot going, where's my car? Where's my car? And then I realized, oh yeah, I didn't make the payments. I didn't have the money. And so I've had those events in my life that, you know, I swore would never happen again. And so I think that feeds into that. Yeah, you got to work. And now understand, maybe not as hard.
I can't help but wonder too, is it about the money or is it about the emotional disparity and scarcity that happened in developmental years? Because it sounds like we have actually similar patterns, and I grew up with a lot of money and more physical things than I could ever think of, but still my system is in that mode of scarcity. Will anything show up to support me, you know?
Yeah, and if I don't do it, nobody's going to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I always have thought, well, I was homeless for a time in my life in college. I drove a school bus and was in college, and, you know, oddly enough, even when I graduated from college, no one came. That didn't mean anything to my family. Nobody came for my family. A few friends showed up, but no, my family never. Even in grad school, never. No one showed up. Mm. When I look back at that, that just reinforces that, you know, I got fired from a job years ago, before I even went back to college. And I remember leaving there thinking, I don't want to work for anyone ever again, because people fire you and I didn't understand why. And today I know why. It's because of my own neurodiversity was coming in. My own uniqueness didn't fit with their idea of what they thought. You know, they were anti everything that I was a believer in. They were anti everything at that job, but they had every right to fire me because I didn't meet what they wanted. I wasn't who they wanted, and I'm very, you know, I don't blame them now. You know, I remember hating them for a day or two or a year or three, and now, you know, it taught me that my neurodiversity is such that people are going to assume things that aren't always true about me because of how I work so hard to project something different. Mm-hmm. And people are going to also assume at times that I'm weird and different and that I don't belong. I've been in all those places. There's groups that don't want me. I've been there. Yeah. Wow. How did you do that? I don't know, Shelby. I think that's part of us just hanging out in this conversation because it's flooded right now with how many times I've been rejected.
Yeah. And I'm just right here with you. Yeah. You mentioned neurodiversity, and we were talking, you had mentioned a poem, I think, by David White before we started talking, and I have no idea if that feels like it would be interesting in this moment, but I was curious.
Well, I will tell you what he wrote. It was on maturity. And I believe that maturity is also part of co-regulation. I don't think we co-regulate without maturity. So he said that it's the ability to live fully and equally in multiple contexts, most especially the ability, despite our grief and losses, to courageously inhabit the past, the present, and the future all at once. The wisdom that comes from maturity is recognized through a disciplined refusal to choose between or isolate three powerful dynamics that form human identity: what has happened, what is happening now, and what is about to occur. Immaturity is shown by making false choices, living only in the past, or only in the present, or only in the future, or even living only two out of the three. Maturity is not a static arriving platform where life is viewed from a calm, untouched oasis of wisdom, but a living elemental frontier between what has happened, what is happening now, and consequences of the past and present, first imagined and then lived into the waiting future. Maturity calls us to risk ourselves as much as immaturity, but for a bigger picture, a larger horizon, for a powerfully generous outward incarnation of our inward qualities and not the gains that make us smaller, even in the winning. Yeah. It just seems so important to realize that I am enough. You're enough, Shelby. We're enough. We have just as many rights to be here as anybody else. We have just as many rights to feel bypassed or shamed. We have just as many rights to have feelings and emotions. And it doesn't make us crazy because we get upset. It doesn't make us any of those things, except this is how my human shows up with your human. And understanding, you know, it dawned on me a couple weeks ago that great minds think alike. I heard that all my life. Oh, great minds think alike is a lie. Great minds don't think alike. They're all thinking uniquely different. And who was more neurodiverse than Einstein, for goodness sakes? Or Benjamin Franklin. I mean, there's some neurodiversity. And just coming into it and realize it doesn't mean that I have another label. It just means that I don't have a label, that I am doing the best I can, and this is just who I am.
Yeah.
Right in this moment.
And somehow I think that comes to belonging, you know, when we don't see it as a label. And, you know, I identify as very neurodiverse now that I'm learning about it, which is, I think it's been such a gift because there, I have a sense of belonging all of a sudden where I'm going, oh my goodness, all of these sensitivities, all of these unique quirks, all of these needs I have, they matter. And I'm not the only one that feels this. others feel this too. Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah. That's a phrase I repeat every day. Others feel this too. When I think I'm having such a unique experience that's full of suffering. And I'm really glad that you read that, because I don't know. His writings just touch the soul.
They're very powerful. He's a very powerful influencer for sure. And it just makes so much sense. Just, yeah. It's hard to be in the moment. But again, it just keeps coming back. That's all we really have is this moment. And just not to sound willy-nilly about it, it's just the truth. This is where we are.
And we sure have a hard time being here when we've experienced trauma and we haven't gotten some supportive, nurturing co-regulation in our lives. You had mentioned, or the poem had mentioned, being in the past, present, and future. And you said earlier that that was a marker of healing, I think. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, yeah. I believe that that's true co-regulation. When you're able to get to that place where you can be in all three at the same time. And I think, Shelby, that because of where we were in life without a protector who really wanted to protect us from the outside forces, that a lot of adult things leaked into our spaces, into our minds, into our bodies. A lot of adult things came too quickly, because we didn't have a protector. And as we got older, those forces that were leaking in were trauma and made us more vulnerable to trauma, more vulnerable to being, you know, even though I've been pushed back all my life, it still hurts when I get pushed back. It's never gone away. I think that's trauma. I think that that's an awareness of, yeah, no protector. Why would I expect something different?
Yeah.
Except trauma to find me.
Yeah. I'm just taking it all in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me too.
I'm curious. We could probably talk for hours, but we can wrap up soon. I'm just curious what it's like to have shared all of this today.
I would say that some people will find it too much. Some people will find it not enough. I hope that people are able to hear it with compassion and realize that storytelling heals. And even as we're having this conversation, I'm healing, you're healing through the stories, and it's just, I'm sure someone will use some part of it against me. That's my history. And part of me is like, I don't feel any shame about saying who I am or where I've been, that it's just, you know, this was my roller coaster ride that lasted a lifetime. And just who I am.
Yeah. It's so striking to hear you say, I'm sure somebody will use this against me. And there's a part of me that wants to argue with me. Or argue with you. And a part of me appreciates maybe the level of acceptance that this is just how people are when they project onto us or perceive us in certain ways. And when we can understand that it's none of our business what people think about us, we're a lot more free.
Much more free. Much more free. And somebody that we don't even really know their opinion. Why did that matter so much at some point? It did to me. And now it's like, okay. Just okay.
And I think there's something going on in this conversation too that people can't see, because there is a somatic component of our connection, of our conversation. And I imagine this conversation would have gone completely differently 2 years ago, having built the trust with each other, built the ability to allow parts of ourselves out. I don't have the usual level of lack of trustworthiness that I carry, hypervigilance, tension, rigidity, holding my breath. There's just a feeling of allowing and availability and curiosity of, I wonder what's next, what wants to come through next, which feels so different than how it might have felt in the past.
Yeah, I definitely think that's the mystery, is what we live in our faith of what we're doing becomes stronger. And as it becomes stronger, we realize we know less and less and less. And it's just about, if I have clean shelves and everything is clean in me, then I have more room for you. And having more room for you opens up the door to all sorts of experiences that I would have never experienced. So gratitude for that. Yeah.
Well, this is my kind of fun. You asked me once if I have any idea how to have fun, and I still haven't answered you.
But I'm still waiting.
This is my kind of fun.
I'm with you.
I really appreciate you giving your time. And are there any programs or things that you're offering in the world where people can come find you?
Well, austinattach.com, AustinAttach.com is my website. And they can come. There's Transforming the Experience-Based Brain, which is a learning program about working with those with developmental trauma. What's important about that is that oftentimes people come through for themselves. They start going, this is more about me than it is, I'm going to put it into practice. I have transforming groups, as we were able to come out of the pandemic, hoping that they're going to be happening more and more, which gives more intimate work, close work with another person in a group setting, very limited number of people. And somatic resilience and regulation, of course, is there. And we have a co-regulatingtouch.com website where there's therapists are on there around the world. If somebody's got developmental trauma or experienced developmental trauma, and understanding, I think I would just like to say that my pet peeve about trauma is when people believe that their trauma is worse than anyone else's, or that their client has really bad trauma. Oh, it's horrible trauma. Is that trauma is not measured by experience. Trauma is measured by outcome of that experience. And some people are just as debilitated because they can't move forward from little trauma as there are big trauma. So we don't need to separate into big and little. Just say, where you are is fine.
Yeah.
You're doing the best you can. You're still alive.
Yeah. I had a moment yesterday morning when I felt this wave of grief come through. It was just before sitting with a client. I realized, I was like, I don't actually even think this is mine. I don't know. And this message, I heard this message and it was, we all just want somebody to sit by our side and tell us we're doing a good job, no matter where we're at. If we're really deeply suffering from the trauma, if we're feeling free, we just want people there to be reflecting with these kind, compassionate, connected eyes that we're all doing a really good job right where we are. And what you said somehow just reminded me of that.
Yeah, we are. And that's all we have to do, Shelby. Just sit.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much. I will be in your Transforming Experience Brain training next year.
Yeah.
And hopefully some folks will join us from the podcast. And I just love to thank you. For everything.
You can also continue the conversation between us is on your program. You should, because I was interviewed for your program that is for healthcare providers to understand working with trauma a bit differently.
Yes. Yeah. Creating Safer Healthcare. Stephen is a guest teacher and talking more about regulation, talking about adverse childhood experiences and how that gives us a lot of information for how we can really help people feel safe enough to receive their treatments and show up for their care. So,
yeah.
Yes. Thank you for your work in the world and your book and being in my life and for supporting everyone listening today through everything you've shared. So, have a beautiful day.
You too. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. Before you go, if you loved our conversation today, make sure you're subscribed and leave a 5-star review so we can get the word out to anyone that this might be supportive or inspiring to. Also, if you're a coach or a therapist, Embodied Coaching Experience is open now for enrollment until the last week of January. Or until it fills up. It's already getting quite full and there is a limited space. These are intimate, supportive experiences where you get to have client consultation, lean into a group of like-minded colleagues who are doing incredible work in the world, feel connected, loved up, and supported as you're navigating being a coach, a therapist, or a care provider in a way that's trauma-informed, deeply embodied, and full of heart. Thank you so much for joining me today, and we will see you on next week's episode.